I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Tim Sanders was a chief solutions officer at Yahoo from 2001 to 2005. His previous book is Love is the Killer App, which was a New York Times bestseller, and he's a sought-after speaker on the lecture circuit. He's been featured on sundry publications and programs on television and radio. He joins me now to discuss his new book, Saving the World at Work. It's an inspiring book about the responsibility revolution seen in the corporate world, where companies go beyond making profits and rather think about the difference they're making in the world. We'll talk about some of the companies where we're seeing innovation, as well as what one can do no matter their position in a company. The full title of the book is Saving the World at Work, What Companies and Individuals Can Do to Go Beyond Making a Profit to Making a Difference. It is published by Doubleday and retails for $27.95. TimSanders.com is his website. SavingTheWorld.net is also worth a view. For more information on this way of thinking, please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Tim Sanders. Good morning, Mr. Sanders.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. What does the Chief Solutions Officer at Yahoo do?
Well, it was a position invented during WWW1 in 2002. We call that World War on the Web 1, and it's a risk management position. So I worked on either the biggest risks or the biggest deals at the company. So we were being thrown out of France because of auction goods we shouldn't have had on our side. I get on a plane. If we're going to try to close a $50 million deal with Hewlett Packard, I get on a plane. So it's, I always say it's like the Harvey Keitel, the wolf character from Pulp Fiction.
And you left the company. Why?
Well, in 2005, I was doing so many lectures and working so hard on this book that we just published, I felt like I didn't have the time to meet my responsibilities, so I parted ways, but I continue to be a Yahoo and support them and their foundation work.
And so this, going on the lecture circuit and stuff like that, and in this book, this is a full-time job for you now?
Yeah, it's what I do. I mean, it's interesting. I consider myself first and foremost a researcher, so I probably spend the greatest number of my waking hours reading research I've aggregated from a variety of sources, mostly on business trends, especially branding and employment trends. That I'm very fascinated with that, have been for years.
Now, that term, responsibility revolution, I can't speak this morning, it's in quotes. When did that come up? Or like, well, when did this start? When did this become in fashion, I guess?
It's been a decade long. It's been bubbling up. I mean, the responsibility revolution is a change in how people make decisions to buy things, do business with companies, take jobs, and even invest. And this revolution in thought has been punctuated by teachable moments over the last decade. I mean, depending on where you live, take your pick. Enron, WorldCom, the meltdown made us very suspect of companies, and we realized we had to work at companies with strong values or pay the consequences. September the 11th, at least for the lower 48, was a teachable moment about interdependence. Hurricane Katrina did the same thing. School shootings have done it. The inconvenient truth is now a belief system around the planet. So all of these different actions happening in a concentrated period of time has shocked the collective consciousness, and we feel a sense of urgency to make a difference with how we spend our money and where we put our efforts, whether it's for the planet, local communities, or even the people that we know that are dying a little bit each day at work.
Do you find, though, that there is still much apathy in the United States, at least?
It depends on which segment you look at. I mean, there's about 40, 50 million Americans that are actively engaged in social responsibility. They're paying a premium to do the right thing. They're telling upwards to 25 to 50 people a week where they should work and where they should spend their money. And with the current economic meltdown, that particular group, they call it the LOHAS group, Lifestyles of Health and Sustainability, it's going to be about 70% of consumer power and about 85% of investment power by 2010, 2012. So it's really a question of which group. I mean, there's always going to be apathetic groups everywhere you go, but people that are concerned about green, they also happen to be people that have the wealth and means to do it.
You mentioned an inconvenient truth, the Al Gore picture, being a factor in sort of engaging people and in sort of motivating people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find at this point in time, because we are in an election year in your country, that it sort of people who think responsibly, who think ethically, or I shouldn't say that, who buy socially or consume socially, that it's still a partisan issue? It's a very polarizing thing?
Well, if you believe the federal government's the solution.
I guess you're right, yeah.
I mean, you know, the point of my book is that well, I don't say it in the book, but I don't have a strong belief system when it comes to intervention. I mean, I'm agnostic about it. I mean, we all have to make a difference. So the point of the book really is that business is probably in the best position to make a difference on fixing broken communities as well as environmental protection. They're much more efficient. They're much better capitalized than the government or NGOs. And what I'm learning is that today is a watershed moment for the sustainability movement, and here's why. Companies from Walmart to GE and everybody in between, even CIBC here in Canada, has learned this. Green is about green. In other words, you save money going green. And the reason why is because companies realize that sustainability starts with the reduction of waste, much of which costs money. And you tear up legacy way of doing things, how you consume and ship information, how you design products, how you deliver products, and you reinvent business where at the end of the day you lower your footprint and you also lower your bills. And it's really contagious once companies realize green is free. And it's just like the quality movement of the 70s where it looked to us, you know, getting pummeled by Japanese competitors who did it better. It looked to us like it was a fad. It looked to us like quality was too expensive to make available to every American. And between 1977 and 1982, 2 million Americans lost their job to superior competitors overseas that figured it out. And that's what's going to happen during the sustainability revolution over the next decade or so.
Well, what companies are we seeing that aren't being innovative? And are they, and is, I guess is the point of the book, is they're becoming irrelevant, aren't they?
Well, most of the book's about who's getting it right. But if I were to just pick on a couple of companies.
Yeah, do that.
The big three in Detroit are paying a dear price for going last. Toyota scoffed at in the mid-90s when they were spending tens of millions of dollars on the Synergy program, which led to Prius. Toyota did some scenario planning 15 years ago, and they dreamed of a world that was entirely plausible, where there would be an intersection between an increasing price of gasoline and environmental sensitivity, and when the two lines connected, people would begin to purchase cars to say something about themselves, thus the Toyota Prius. 2000, 2001, it begins to sell. By 2004, Toyota became the number two car seller in the U.S. By the way, next year they'll be number one in the U.S. And many researchers believe what happened was Toyota had something called the halo effect on their brand. So what the Prius did was redefined Toyota as having a lock on green values. So now, the big three in Detroit, the same group that killed the electric car and buried it in a hole in the desert, you know, over a decade ago, are spending billions and billions of dollars as they bleed red ink to consultants that are charging them 10 times more than they charged Toyota a decade ago. And they're having to write checks to Toyota and Nissan to lease hybrid technology to catch up. And it's a classic example of what happens when you go late and you think in 90 days, because you see in 2006, 85% of all of Detroit's profits were driven by SUVs and light trucks. I call that being invested in the mink coats. And that's changed, and they went late, and it should be an example for almost every other industry. And I see leaders in industries as unusual as defense contractors to theme park managers learning a lesson from this and beginning to look at sustainability as an innovation question and not a political issue.
You mentioned Walmart. A lot of people in this country, and I guess in the United States as well, they just don't like Walmart. But what is Walmart doing to sort of improve itself?
So first of all, the reason we don't like Walmart fundamentally is how it treats employees and what it's doing to local merchants. We realize that there's a real crisis, you know, not only in the United States but in Canada around local communities. So it's caused us to have a distaste, and Walmart realized that. And they had consulting groups come back to them a few years ago and say, look, the next generation is going to go out of their way not to buy from you, and you have, you know, you're not always going to have your Chinese joint venture with a cost advantage. In 2005, Walmart decided the low-hanging fruit was sustainability. They went on a waste reduction program. They created something, and I believe that, by the way, Walmart's made a bigger difference to the environmental movement than Al Gore when it comes down to it, and here's why. In 2005, they created a sustainability report card, which basically said to 60,000 manufacturers that put products on their shelves, you will shrink product packaging by 30% or lose our business, and you will have a very short time to do it. And I was at a meeting in Toronto that Procter & Gamble Canada and Coke Canada were putting on the day after the announcement, and they said, it's an earthquake. And I said, why? And they said, Walmart sells five, I'm sorry, they sell one out of six CDs. They sell one out of eight bottles of Coke. They sell one out of 10 organic sweaters. They said, they are market share. You have to change everything to stay in business with Walmart. And you don't just change one factory, you change everything. We look up today, 3 years later, Coke's gone green. Why? Because they had no choice, because you have to stay on sale at Walmart. So Walmart created this sustainability report card because they figured out that about 70% of their carbon footprint was in their supply chain, meaning the shipping and the production of the products that came to their shelves. And much like how Toyota reduced their footprint by requiring us to use less gas, Walmart did the same thing. And by the way, Walmart has saved approximately $750 million over the last 3 years on reduced storage, shipping, and management warehousing costs because of the shrink form factor. And that's one of the many things Walmart's done in their initiative. It's somewhat improved their reputation, but I continue to say they've got to get the people and community part right to repair their reputation.
So you're showing us that it does save money in the long run.
If you do it right.
Yeah, but just from a consumer point of view, being green in your home is probably a lot more expensive than you know, not thinking socially.
Not so, really. No, if you think that, then you don't get it. Not you personally, but I mean the home. Because here's what, like, the EPA would say about green buildings. 90% of the footprint of green buildings is about whether or not your appliances are LEED compliant and your kids have a habit of turning off the lights when they leave a room. That's 90% of it. What your home is made of is such a small part of its overall footprint during its life. A lot of people mistakenly think that being green is about buying more expensive ingredients that are sustainable. And the way to think about it, and then that's partially true, but it's not the lion's share of what we're talking about. Sustainability's got four R's. Reduce waste, which saves money. Reuse things and delay purchasing new things, which saves money. Recycle, which costs money. And replace unsustainable ingredients, which cost a lot of money. What I've learned is you do the first two. You save money, you create an internal budget, and you take half of it, and you begin to invest in recycling and replacement. That's how I see green buildings spreading in the commercial sector, and hopefully that's what consumers will learn, is if you want to go green, replace all your lights with compact fluorescent light bulbs, and you'll cut your energy bills. Put sensors in so everything turns off when you leave a room. Never buy an appliance that's not LEED. Turn all of your computers off every night. Never leave anything on charge. They're vampires. If you adopt waste reduction as your central green strategy, green's free.
And why do you think it is, though, that people think it's so expensive?
They're being marketed to spend more money on going green.
Really?
Well, it's just like, you know, it's old right guard marketing. Guess what? You stink. Well, we didn't stink until Procter & Gamble convinced us that, you know, and Dial convinced us that we stunk. And they invented an industry called personal hygiene. And, you know, we're out telling people right now, you need to go spend $14 on an organic chicken, which, by the way, I eat organic, so fair disclosure. But there's a lot of marketing that says you spend more to go green, and there's a lot of cause marketing that says you go pay too much at the Gap so they can solve malaria in the third world. And while I applaud cause marketing, the American consumers are being told that green is expensive, but the real American sustainability experts are telling you that done correctly, green is free.
It's also funny how they've marketed green to be chic almost, and that it's almost fashionable now.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's somewhat, you know, that's the part of it that may be faddish, but the part that's not faddish is the responsibility part, and that's the urgency that every day when we leave the lights on, send a package overnight when it could have gone ground, print a PDF document that's 85 pages on virgin paper, we are stealing from somebody else's grandkids. We're stealing days that they can go outside and play without the weather being intolerable. We're stealing days where they can live in houses that are not washed out by hurricanes. You know, the hurricane season used to be over July 31st at the turn of the 20th century. I mean, we're stealing from the future, and I think that awesome sense of responsibility will only increase over time.
The other interesting thing, there are a couple of good stories in there. I'm going to save the Xbox story for the end, because I think I was just reading that, and I just was moved by it. But there's a story in there about a woman who worked in a company, and she gave a book, and I forget the title of the book now, to the CEO, and it sort of changed the entire company's view on consumption. What's the company?
The company is called Interface Floor. They make modular carpet for office buildings. In 1994, this woman, Joyce LaValle, regional vice president in Los Angeles, received a book from her daughter who had attended a lecture by the environmentalist Paul Hawken. The book's called The Ecology of Commerce. Premise of the book is that companies are either going to save or kill the planet, and the CEOs are either going to be criminals or captains. It depends on their choice. The daughter sends the book to her mom and says, "Your CEO doesn't get it. He needs to read the book. The carpet industry is in big trouble." The mom, not being directly, you know, reporting to the CEO, has to go through this elaborate, you know, Ocean's 11 type strategy to get the book on the corner of the guy's desk at the right moment, at the right time. The CEO puts the book in his briefcase, and when he reads it that night, he says it was a spear to his heart. He had a Scrooge-like Dickens experience. He woke up the next day with a new vision for the company called Mission Zero, Zero Impact on the Planet by 2020. He asked all of his managers the next week to reimagine how to make carpet in a world where oil was too expensive to burn. They reduced 70% of their footprint in the first 5 years and saved $300 million. He's now considered the Rosa Parks of the environmental movement, and when he wrote his memoir, Mid-Course Correction, a few years later, about that realization he came to and how you could reinvent business, he acknowledged and dedicated the book in part to Melissa Gildersleeve LaValle, the daughter, who originally started this process by asking her mom to stand up, get out of her comfort zone. And when I heard that story, and I think about the 100 million pounds of carpet that aren't going to go into landfill because of one woman's courage, it caused me to just ask people, if not you, then who?
And it doesn't matter one's position in the company, does it?
No, not during a revolution. You know, during a revolution, it's not who you know, it's what you know. I mean, let's just think about the dot-com thing that happened a few years ago. I mean, you could have, you know, a tattoo on the back of your neck and a nose ring. But if the CEO became alarmed that he didn't understand how to use the internet, you were showing him, and he called you by your first name, and you had a new title called Chief Information Officer, Chief Technology Officer, and it was a real changing of the guard. Right now, across North America, including Canadian enterprise, 7 out of 10 CEOs know that CSR and sustainability are two of the most important initiatives they have to grasp and treat as strategic. But many of them also know that less than 10% of their populations at work are actually interested or involved in it. It's the greatest activation gap we've seen since the quality movement of the 70s.
And how are Canadians faring in all of this, or are we making a difference?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that the Canadians have probably ran a few years, much like the Brits, they ran a few years ahead of the U.S. The Canadians weren't. They weren't completely convinced when Milton Friedman at the Chicago School of Economics said that the only responsibility of the company is to make shareholders their money back. I don't think that's ever really fit the Canadian profile for capitalism. So I think it's a lot of the things I talk about in the book are very native, but let me tell you a quick story about CIBC. About a decade ago, I think, or a little bit longer, a handful of tellers in Alberta got excited about a small project at their bank called Run for the Cure. They signed each other up, wore pink shirts, you know, it was a breast cancer research run. And it spread from Alberta to Ontario to Toronto to Montreal to Quebec City. And eventually, a high percentage of the tellers were actually involved every year in the Run for the Cure. And it grew. The new CEO came in several years ago and looked around and saw the excitement. And he had his ad agency to ask two things. What does this mean for employee satisfaction? And what does this mean for customer preference? And they found out it was the number two cause of employee satisfaction besides training. It was the number three cause of customer satisfaction besides product satisfaction and premiums. And so what he did is he reorganized, and he moved this program, Run for the Cure, from the community affairs group to the chief marketing officer, tripled the funding, and today it is the number one fundraiser in all of North America for breast cancer. And it's because that CEO is smart enough to see that this is the new cutting edge of innovation, you know, that intersection between community interests and cause and a company's raw capability, which is people and purpose.
Tim, I want to close on that story at the end of the book, the Xbox story?
Yes.
What company was that?
Can't tell you. I wish I could.
It's
a very litigious company. I wish I could tell you, but let's just say it's a very large company.
And they work in computers, do they?
Or? Yeah. It's really a story about the idea that sometimes we can save the world by just showing some compassion to the person sitting next to us or working for us.
And do you mind telling the story about what it involved? The manager.
Yeah.
And how would we describe him? He's pretty jaded.
Well, you know, he's just an IT manager, and he developed a habit of managing over email because it's a bad habit we have. And at the company during this time, it's like 2002, 2003, there's a dot-com crash, there's a lot of layoffs, recognition was in short supply at companies. You know, you didn't tell people they did well because what if you laid them off next week? It's Exhibit A, you know, in a court of law, you know what I mean? And he realized that he could be doing better as a person. He realized his people were just, you know, really dying a little bit inside every day. It was a terrible work experience. So he decided to go around to all of his engineers, the nine people that reported to him, and give them two pieces of ad hoc praise, one personal and one very professional. And a few days later, one of his employees came back and gave him a gift, which was an Xbox gaming console and a copy of the John Madden football game. And when this manager, who'd hardly spent any time with this engineer, even though he worked with him for almost 2 years, when the manager said, "Where'd you get the money?" the engineer looked back and said, "I sold my chrome-plated 9mm semi-automatic pistol," which you can imagine got this manager very, you know, involved in a conversation about, "What do you mean?" And it turns out, to cut a long and important story short, that this young man was so depressed, he had no friends in the world, spending far too much time online, had joined a suicide chat group, which had instructed him to purchase a beautiful gun and come home and start something called the Final Program, which guarantees that in 90 days, you'll die. And this young man was at the end of the program. And the young man was profoundly affected when this manager, Steve, had the compassion to come into his office the day before, put his arm around him, talk to him about how much he admired his sense of humor and his ability to finish things on time. And he told this young man, "I'm glad you came into my life." And it changed this young man's perception so much of his purpose and his meaning. He sold the gun. And he decided to purchase a gift that he knew his manager was longing for but could not afford, which is this video gaming console. When I heard this story, I added to the question, "If not you, then who?" I asked the second question, "If not now, then when?" Because sometimes we have a big, hairy, audacious goal to save the planet, and that may or may not be within our grasp. But the people sitting next to us right now go through an incredible amount of suffering. And with the current economic climate, it's worse than ever. And if we go to work and we recognize and develop people and hold them up as important, that may be the best way we can save the world at work.
Man, that's such a great story, the story about the Xbox, that it is worth the price of admission, and people ought to buy the book simply for that. But other than that, it's a remarkable and necessary book. Tim, I do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today, and continued good luck with the book.
Thanks, and I invite all the listeners to go to savingtheworld.net. It's like Facebook for adults who want to make a difference. You can go there and let us know how you're trying to save the world, what projects you're working on, what resources you need. You can blog there about your point of view, and other people can find you and tell you how to succeed, because it's a place where knowledge networking, not social networking, knowledge networking happens. And one more time, it's savingtheworld.net.
And Tim's other website is timsanders.com. The book is called Saving the World at Work, What Companies and Individuals Can Do to Go Beyond Making a Profit to Making a Difference. It's published by Doubleday, $27.95. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.